The Escape Pod. Let's go on a trip through time to see what tomorrow looked like yesterday.
Preparing escape pod for launch.
Today was yesterday's tomorrow.
Pressurizing.
Where we are now used to be the unimaginable future.
Fuel.
Nominal.
And today's outdated entertainment used to be yesterday's state of the art.
Power.
Nominal.
Sifting through science fact and science fiction, from outdated technology to the birth of the future. Let's get away from it all for a few minutes by going back the way we came, into logbook.com's escape pod.
Escape pod ready.
It's time to strap into the logbook.com's escape pod, a daily dose of the fantastic, the futuristic, and the unabashedly geeky. I'm Earl Green, and for the next few minutes, let's see what tomorrow looked like yesterday. On this day in 1968, 2 years after he'd built a prototype of the machine that would launch the home video game industry, inventor Ralph Baer was granted what is now referred to as the 480 patent, known to the U.S. Patent Office as patent number 3728480. This patent, describing a television gaming and training apparatus, proved to be Baer's bread and butter, as a succession of companies from Atari to Nintendo had to license the patent from him to produce new video game consoles. At least one judge has referred to the 480 patent as the pioneer patent of the video game industry.
Here we go. Up. And down. And up. He's getting tricky. Missed it. One up. Keep it on the table, Baer. Here we go. Fake you out again. 2-1.
In 1969, it was a space first as the Soviets launched Soyuz 5, which managed to rendezvous and dock with Soyuz 4. The state of technology at the time meant that while the Soyuz vehicles could physically dock, the crews couldn't just move freely between the two in a docking tunnel. Instead, the cosmonauts had to perform a spacewalk to swap spacecraft. Worse yet, when Soyuz 5 returned to Earth with cosmonaut Boris Volynov aboard, his capsule's modules failed to separate properly, leaving him with a lot of dead weight during re-entry. The only way he could get his vehicle into a survivable re-entry profile was to fly it through re-entry hatch first, and that part of the Soyuz vehicle is not shielded against the heat of re-entry. While Soyuz 5 returned intact, the heat of re-entry on the wrong part of the capsule prevented its parachutes from deploying properly, and it landed hard enough that the impact broke some of Volynov's teeth. In 2006, it was a much happier return for NASA's unmanned Stardust sample collection mission, which survived a 29,000 mile per hour re-entry and came to a soft landing in the Utah desert, bearing its precious cargo of particles captured from the tail and the gas and dust clouds surrounding Comet Wild 2.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Pleiades, rapid brightening.
Let's descend, seize it.
Near spec is acquired. We see it.
17 degrees aft. Above Mars. Peak heating.
Oh, that's cool.
Foresight.
Quite a trail.
Near spec has a great view.
Air plasma lines have been detected.
Born on this day in 1927, actress Phyllis Coates, the screen's first Lois Lane. Composer Les Baxter died on this day in 1996. James Hillier, inventor of the electron microscope, died today in 2007. In 1966, it was time to celebrate an unlikely milestone, the 100th episode of Doctor Who.
The plan has failed.
We can't be certain. Although the time-traveling monk has not yet contacted us, we don't know what difficulties he's had to face.
The time traveler has deceived us!
The episode in question was part 10 of the 12-part epic, The Daleks' Master Plan. Of the dozen 25-minute episodes making up that story, this is one of the only three that still exists. In 1980, a bit later than planned, NBC premiered the first part of an eagerly anticipated miniseries based on Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, an all-star international production between NBC and the BBC, starring Rock Hudson, Bernie Casey, and Robert Beatty. Even though it was adapted for TV by highly respected sci-fi writer Richard Matheson, Bradbury had already embarrassed everyone involved in the miniseries by saying that he'd seen the preview and it was boring. NBC quickly yanked The Martian Chronicles out of its original fall 1979 time slot and quietly premiered it in 1980, right before the entire network schedule would be taken over by the 1980 Winter Olympics.
Mankind waited, intense expectation, for the answer to the question that had puzzled him for centuries. Is there life on Mars? Those who had never believed the red planet was inhabited, who shook their heads knowingly as if to say, "We told you so." The believers pointed out that the instruments could only scan as far as the horizon. However, if the spacecraft had only landed a few miles further on, things might have been different.
In 1981, the long-delayed second season of Buck Rogers and the 25th Century premiered, introducing Tom Christopher as Hawk.
"It is sad that I must kill you. You are the only human for whom I have ever had some measure of respect."
"There are a lot of humans just like me, Hawk. Most of them, in fact. I only wish I could convince you of that."
"You cannot."
"It'd be quite a place for a showdown."
"I am at home in the Heights."
"This doesn't make any sense, you know."
"It is inevitable."
"Well, I guess we ought to get on with it."
It had been nearly a year since the first season, and Buck Rogers' new showrunner was faced with a mandate from the network to make the show a bit more like Star Trek, a show NBC had canceled a long time before. And in 2004, another episode of Doctor Who made the news just by showing up.
"The evil one searched for us, but Brett helped us. He said they were evil."
"Yes, well, whoever this Brett is, he's quite right. The Daleks are evil things."
"Brett is the man you put in your magic chair."
"What? That young ruffian?"
"But he helped us."
"And you released him?"
"Was I not right to do so?" "When the evil one came, he said we had to flee from your temple."
"Oh, my TARDIS, child, my TARDIS. Yes, you were right. I mean, he wasn't to know that you were quite safe away from the Daleks in there."
Part two of the Daleks' master plan was located in the possession of the former chief engineer of one of the BBC's TV competitors. He had quietly removed the film rather than destroying it, as instructed during the early 1970s when he was an employee of the BBC. You can read about these events and many more on thelogbook.com's ever-evolving timeline of geek history. The book Vorp 1 is available now, thelogbook.com's 396-page guide to Doctor Who on TV from 1963 through 2011, cross-referencing old episodes and new, and catching you up on the mythology of the longest-running science fiction series in TV history. You can pick up other original books and DVDs and hundreds of other titles in thelogbook.com store anytime. Thanks for listening to The Escape Pod.
Escape Pod was written and produced by Earl Keane.